What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back. Welcome to the High Flyers Podcast, where we do reimagine a high flyer, showcase relatable role models and their journey in work and life, including their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and much, much more to help you achieve your potential, become your best self, and continue to be 1% better every single day. I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal, and let's get started. Today, in this episode 95, I'm speaking with Joel Connolly. We talk about his early years growing up in Darwin and Copacabana and the influence of being raised by a single mum. I asked Joel about his career in the music world, and I love how he reminds us all that we're all born creatives and it gets strangled out as we grow up. For me, this podcast has been the best kind of a creative immersion. And we get into the nitty-gritty of how Joel moved from music to venture capital, joining Blackbird in 2016, his most painful learning, and how to carve out a creative stamp in an investment firm. Stay tuned for fascinating perspective on what crypto has right and wrong about culture and how Australia can encourage more. Vitalik, the founder of Ethereum. It's time to explore your curiosity. Please enjoy. Joel Connolly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. What a joy to be here.
I'm pumped to have you on. I've followed you for quite some time and I love everything you've done and everything you're doing at the moment. So keen to get into it. Let's start with some fun facts. Where were you born and where do you live now?
I was born in Newcastle. And I currently live in Orange in regional New South Wales.
And what was your first job and what do you do now?
My first job, technically, I guess, was delivering pamphlets, but that didn't last long. I'd say my first real job was KFC when I was a teenager.
And how would you describe your role now?
I'm creative director at Blackbird Ventures, and I also am the head of our philanthropic, which is called the Blackbird Foundation.
And we'll get into both of those things shortly. And the purpose of this show, Joel, is to reimagine a high flyer. I wonder, is there a high flyer in your life who you feel hasn't got the recognition they deserve?
You know, this is a funny thing to say because she's quite well known. Like people know her and know her work, but I think that she is, people think that she's really great, but I think she's so much greater than a lot of people even give her credit for, which is saying a lot. Lauren Kaplan, who I work with at Startmate, well, she's at Startmate. I think she just seems to be ahead of everything all the time. Like she's, every time I get to a place and I think I'm like on the fringe of something, she's already there. Like I think she even pitched for my job. My first job at Blackbird was head of community. She pitched Nick Inrick for that like too early, it turns out, like 6 months before they'd raised their second fund. So they didn't obviously have the funds for it. But she pitched that then. Right now, like we're both really into crypto and, you know, Web3. And every time I find a new project, which I think is exciting and interesting, and I go follow it on Twitter, she's always there first. So I actually think, you know, she is really great. People give her a lot of credit, but I think that she's even greater than a lot of people realize.
And listeners, stay tuned. Lauren might be on the show in a couple of weeks' time. So that'll definitely be a cool story. And I completely agree. Lauren's fantastic and very inspiring in her own way. Let's zoom out, Joel, and talk about your sunrise. And I'm fascinated by Newcastle because Nikki grew up in Newcastle as well. And so did Nick Crocker, one of the partners in Blackbird. So there's clearly a trend there, prerequisite, where Newcastle seems to be part of the job description almost for Blackbird. So tell me about your memories about the influence of family and environment growing up in Newcastle.
Well, I was born in Newcastle, which is the question. And then when I was two, we moved to Darwin. So I grew up for half of my life until I was nearly a teenager in Darwin. And then we moved to Copacabana, which is a little beach town on the central coast, about an hour and a half north of Sydney. And my memory, I don't really have very many memories of Newcastle. We were maybe one or two when we left. We drove from Newcastle to Darwin over about a week with, I think I must have been maybe two, and my sister was 6 months old. So my parents drove us up there. My dad was a brickie. maybe still is a rookie. And there was a lot of building and construction going on in Newcastle at that point. In Darwin at that point. I think some of it was related to Cyclone Tracy. I'm not quite sure. But so we moved up there, and my memories of the Northern Territory are just incredible. Like, if I could describe it, I guess in contrast to New South Wales and in, you know, to where I have lived in the past in Sydney and the Central Coast, it's a lot more relaxed. And I think it might have something to do with the temperature, but my memories are, you know, there was the school uniform was not compulsory. Most kids didn't wear it. It was very multicultural. The school that I went to, it was called Alloa Primary School. I wore the uniform, but the uniform was like a Chesty Bonds red shirt with a frill neck lizard on it. And, you know, we had in our front yard, we lived in Housing Commission, which wasn't it like it felt like at the time everyone lived in Housing Commission. It wasn't like a big deal. Like, heaps of my friends and people that I went to school with all lived in these big, beautiful, it was a house. Like, we had a big backyard. We had coconut trees in the front yard, like five or six of these big giant trees overlooking the house. We had a mango tree in the backyard. And I just remember, like, you know, it being hot. We had shutters. We had shutters and fly screens. We didn't have windows. So these metal shutters, you would just open and close. And we would play in our underpants with the hose, like we just hose each other and play in sprinklers and stuff. And, you know, we'd go to the pool. There was like, there was a local pool, Parat Pool, that we used to go and hang out in. They used to have bands play at the pool. Like, it was just so chill relative to when I went to move to Copacabana. It was a public school in this like little beach town on the Central Coast, but we all wore these really crisp uniforms. We had to stand at attention every single morning. You know, and I found the contrast to be quite dramatic.
What about your influences growing up? Like, when I think back to mine, like, parents were a big influence, which I've only appreciated as I've gotten older in life. When you're younger, you're like, you want to be cool and you want to kind of have your own identity. Who would you say were your influences growing up that shaped your thinking?
Well, obviously, like, you know, you live with your parents and your immediate family. So I'd say there's obviously an impact there. I think, I learned from my, my dad left when I was pretty young, and I'd say that the influence from him was like the opposite of what you want to do. So I, you know, just kind of shaped myself in opposition to, to the sort of person that he is. So I guess that's like maybe a negative influence, but I remember this guy that we were family friends with. His name was Jeff, and I haven't thought about him in decades, but he was a paramedic. He was a triathlete. He was just this really, like, nice, like, together dude, and I always remember looking up to him quite a lot. And I guess reflecting back on that, I guess it was just because he was so together, and he rode a motorbike, and he liked to save people's lives every day, and he just seemed like a cool hero dude. But I had these, like, I looked up to, like, celebrities, I think, like, not celebrities, but I was really into like Macaulay Culkin when he became when he got famous. I saw a lot of myself in him. I think I wanted to be like Kevin. And I think I had a little crush on Christina Ricci. And I think these are like young kind of people that become actors and are in movies and stuff. So I, you know, that's a tough question. I haven't thought about it from a childhood perspective, like who was influential on me as a kid. But I don't know. There are three examples.
And do you want to talk to your mum? I think your point around your dad, given you've mentioned it, that was one of the things that your wonderful wife Steph mentioned, is the fact that you're raised by a single mum, and I've actually had a lot of guests on the show who've talked about the influence of a single parent. And the reason I ask that is because there might be listeners who might be a single parent, or maybe they've grown up with a single parent and are doing it tough, or have learned a lot from it, and maybe they're inspired by your story. Is there anything you want to share about your mum that listeners might be inspired by?
Yeah, well, I don't think I fully appreciated the single parent thing until, you know, I'm a parent now. I've got two children and I'm married. I don't think I fully appreciated what it was like for her, or what it would have been like, until I became an adult. But my memory is of, like, you know, we never had any money. Like, and I know that we had to move around a lot to different houses because we were renting for a lot of years, and you know, we did move, like I said, from Darwin to Copacabana. So there was like flux and change in our life. But my memory is that we just, despite all of this, like we never went without. We had this really like lovely upbringing. Teenage years were a little tough for various reasons, but I think like what I took from my mum is probably a stoicism. Like she never made it, like she did make a deal about it, like sometimes when we were growing up, about the challenges and how hard it was. But a lot of the time she would just deal with things herself. And you know, there might be a little bit of guilt you'd feel, intended guilt, I think. But I think for the most part, she just dealt with a lot of the challenges and the hardship herself. And I feel like I'm quite like that now. Like I don't need to share. I'm quite open with, you know, my feelings and, you know, how I think about things. And if I'm going through stuff, I don't mind sharing and telling the people around me what's happening. But I don't generally need people to, like, I don't need other people to help me through things or to, like, I can get through things on my own. And I think I kind of took that from her, that sort of begrudging stoicism, if you'd call it that.
Love it. And do you remember when you first, like, you obviously spent a lot of time in music, which we'll get to shortly, and you're a very creative person and you've got all these varying interests. Do you remember the first time you came across music or the creative world in general in your teens and what that first kind of reflection was?
Yeah, so we grew up with music in our house. My mum was a big music fan and we always had, you know, really, actually, like at the time I didn't like it, but I reflect back now, like actually quite cool music. So mum's been a huge Nick Cave fan her whole life. And, you know, we were listening to PJ Harvey and Patti Smith and, you know, all these kind of bands that I look back on now and are like these really influential, incredible bands that I look up to. And I see a lot of the artists that I like now have drawn influence from them. So we always had like music in the house. And I think as a teenager, I found, a bit of identity in music. Like I started listening to, I guess, Triple J and Triple J bands when I was like an early teenager. And I remember, you know, kind of carving out a sense of who I was as a reflection of the music that I was listening to. But I think like the first real example of being exposed to creative stuff myself and making things myself was drama classes. Like I started doing drama classes when I was, I think maybe 8 or something. And I, you know, have done theater and drama up until I was, you know, in my 20s ever since then. And I think that was like, if you've ever done drama or theater, like the whole point of these classes is you make stuff. Like you come up with things on the spot, you invent ideas and plays and, so I think that was like my first experience actually making stuff myself rather than absorbing things.
And on that point, I'd be curious, like particularly when you finish school, what's the pathway into music? It's not like a business degree or a science or a medical part of the world where you've got a set kind of steps where you do 1, 2, 3 and then you get to a certain role. What was that thought process like when you finished school? Did you know you wanted to get into the music industry?
No.
Yeah. <okay.
laughs> I mean, I loved music. I was really into organizing in creative spaces, I guess you'd say. I did this really interesting degree at Charles Sturt in Bathurst. It was called a Bachelor of Arts Communication in majoring in theater media. And that degree taught me how to make things, how to build things and how to just carve your own path. And so when I left university, I didn't quite know what to do because what do you do with a theater degree? the answer is nothing. Like you learn an incredible amount. I could talk all about like, you know, what I think I got out of that degree and how like formative it was for me, but it doesn't give you, it's not like going and doing law where the obvious answer is you're going to be a lawyer or, you know, go to accounting and you're going to go be an accountant. Like it's not like that. You have to like think of things yourself and come up with a path of your own. And so I left and I worked in local government running arts programs and events for like a couple of years. I was like an events assistant and I found that to be not very fulfilling. And I was really into bands and I discovered in Sydney there was this radio station, community radio station called FBI, and I started listening to FBI, and I started like hearing about all these like bands that were underground, or you know, that weren't being played on Triple J, but they were playing shows in Sydney and you could go and see them. And I really got into this one band called Wall Space, and I wrote to them on MySpace at the time. I was like, can I buy a CD? Or can I buy something from you? This was in the days of CDs, like streaming and digital wasn't really a, it was sort of a thing, but not really. And they were like, we don't have any. And I was like, oh, well, can you burn me some? And they're like, maybe you can help us get some. And so I called a friend of mine, Greg, who I went to university with, and he was already managing bands, working with in music. And I asked him, I was like, what do? These guys want help. And he's like, just help them. So I started just helping them. And then he and I decided, well, we should help a band together. And we're like, we need a band to work on together, and we'll like co-help them. And we found this band called Lekingst, Lekingste. E on the end, maybe. Anyway, we started working with them, and then it became apparent. We thought we were doing a record label, but we weren't. What we were doing was management, artist management. And so we started taking it more seriously and working with them just in our spare time. And then we met another band called Cloud Control, and they were just sort of starting out. And then they started to get successful. We started helping them, and slowly it starts taking up more of your time on the weekends, to the point where you realize you should actually go and take it more seriously and do it as a job. And so I quit my job at council, and I got weekend jobs. So I got a job at the Apple store. I was like fixing iPhones and selling Macs. And I worked at a tennis court Thursday nights, paying me like $8 an hour while I was also doing a master's at the time, because I didn't know what to do with my life. And yeah. So I was like studying a master's. And so I did all these things, and that let me do the bands full time during the day. And eventually the business just grew from there.
And did you feel a sense of your creative outlet was being used when you were in this space? Because I've never worked in music, but I think music is kind of the definition of creativity and trying things. Did you sense that when you were doing it? You're like, wow, there's all these people are like me, that I fit into this environment.
No, I never saw myself as creative until maybe my mid-30s. You know, I saw myself as a supporter of creative people. And I still am to this day, but I never saw myself as a creative person. I thought that the people I worked with were the artists, and I equated creativity with artistry. I thought they were the same thing back then. And so I found that there was an outlet in like a creative outlet in the work. Like you could help with, you know, demos come through, you give feedback on the music, or you need to come up with album artwork or a tour poster but I really saw my role as like supporting creative people. I didn't really see myself as a creative person myself at that point.
That's so interesting you say that, because I think people, it's kind of like leadership, right? People say, are you born a leader? Do you become a leader? And it sounds like creativity is similar, where you can morph into creativity. It's not something you're born with and you're playing with crayons from day one.
Actually, I disagree with that, and here's why. I think everyone is creative from the moment they're born. Like babies are some of the most, and your little children, if you spend any time with young kids, they're the most creative beings ever. They're so creative. And what happens is, over time, because we historically don't value creativity as well as we should, we don't understand it broadly. I think that's true. I think creativity gets strangled out of people when they're, you know, young, and it's education, but then it's also home and community. People think of creativity as artistry, and artistry is something that's a hobby that you do in your spare time. But every single person who's worth their salt, who's good at anything, is creative. Like, and I think that the journey is that you should go through as an adult is trying to rediscover your creativity and to get it back. There's lots of work we have to do to try and make sure that we don't strangle creativity out of people. And we know lots of people are working on that. But I think that a worthwhile thing to investigate as like a grown person is to rediscover your creativity and your passion through your creativity.
Yeah, such a good point, and thanks for correcting me. I think my creativity is this podcast. How often do you get a chance to ask questions for an hour? So absolutely.
This is incredibly creative work. Sorry to cut you off there. It's incredibly creative. You have to like start an episode with before you start the episode and you're doing your research, not much of an idea about a person. You have to delve into who they are. You have to use your imagination to connect dots about their life. And you have to then use your creativity to figure out what questions you can ask them that will turn an interesting story. Even understanding what a story is and what makes a good story is a creative act. So I would say, I don't know if you, do you consider yourself to be creative? Have you thought about that before?
I do actually. I'd go a step further and go, it's a piece of art. Every episode for me is a piece of art where it is done like with gloves on and you polish it and you do it properly and every time. And that's the, we're kind of digressing here, but it's worth talking about. It's kind of media, as you know as well. Every time you do it is what counts. It's like quality over quantity. And the second that quality drops off, the audience disappears with that. And that can be a responsibility, or it can be really exciting going, this is a challenge I've got each time. It's kind of like a performer, music performer, right? Every time you go to on a concert or a stage, people are expecting something of you and they go, are you going to deliver that quality? The second you don't, people switch off and they have other options. And I think you spoke about it in another podcast where you said we've got so many options now. So when we choose to listen to something or choose to do something, it's a choice we make, and podcasting is absolutely a choice that people make to listen to.
100%. So think about what the word creation is in creativity, right? And what, if anything, is like making a podcast? It's an act of creation. There was not something in the world. You did some work, came up with some ideas, you made a thing, and now there is something in the world that was not in the world previously. That's creation. That's creativity.
Spot on. Yeah, I think that's the best way to describe it, and it's not overcomplicated, right? So That's the key takeaway there. I want to go into the time when you decided it was time to step away from music, and there was something called Blackbird Ventures that was knocking on your door, and I understand you moved to Orange at that time as well, so there's a fair bit of change happening, and now it all kind of fits in, and it's a line that connects, but I'm sure at that point it perhaps was daunting and you made some big moves. Take us inside your thought process. Like, how did you, and this is part that really fascinates me back to kind of creativity, is how did you decide to step away from a field that you'd spend so much time in, and why Blackbird? What was the kind of magnet that attracted you to Blackbird?
Yeah, really good questions. I've thought about these a lot because it didn't, I think the rationally at the time, if you look at my world at that point, it didn't kind of make sense that I would leave music and go to Blackbird. I think the short answer is we had been working for a lot of years on our business called Umbrella Artist Management. And we were, the story of a lot of business and work in the creative industries, particularly the music industry, is one where you have these incremental successes, very small incremental successes. And so we never had, I wouldn't say we didn't have any major setbacks ever really, except one where we were running a music festival for Young Henrys and we lost some money on that. But other than that, mostly like our bands were slowly getting more successful. They were playing bigger venues. They were selling more records. And in fact, like the month that I left and started at Blackbird, one of our bands, the Rubens, who I was managing at the time, won the Hottest 100, which is like Triple J Hottest 100. If you don't know, it's like in Australia, it's kind of the biggest deal. It's the biggest thing that you can achieve. Like we have the Arias, they're different to the Grammys. It's not quite the same. Arias are a measure of sales. Hottest 100 is like your key audience, which is Triple J. They all vote on songs. So our band won the Hottest 100, which I never in a million years thought that, you know, that would happen. I grew up listening to Triple J, listening to the Hottest 100. It was an incredible, thing to achieve. And I was like super proud and excited. And it felt like there was a part of me that was like, is this the beginning of our business? Because up to this point, I would say our business was not, it was okay, but we were struggling. Like we were making money every year, but we were then growing the business and hiring people. And, you know, we weren't taking home that much money ourselves. And it just became like, I sort of looked forward and after we won the Hottest 100, and I was like, we just put a Horton Pavilion on sale as well, which is like 5,000 tickets in Sydney. Again, like if you know venues, like a lot of bands get up to the Enmore, which is a 2,000 capacity venue. To go to the Horden is a huge jump and really like a big deal. So we'd won the Hottest 100, put on a Horton Pavilion. But I looked forward and I was like, how long will this last for, this feeling of success? And what impact will it, lasting impact will it have on our business? And I just thought the structure that we had at the time, we had three partners, so all drawing like down three partner size, you know, salaries. I just felt that it wasn't going to change things meaningfully in the long term. And I had meeting Nikki and Blackbird was just chance. Like, I had a really good friend of mine who I knew for music, but who moved over to tech, named Dylan Baskind, and he founded a company called Quilla. And he introduced me to Nikki. And at the time I was sort of half thinking that we would pitch them for work, that we would try and run this event that they were running called Sunrise. And so I was meeting Nikki like kind of half like thinking that that's what was going to happen. And we met at a cafe in Surry Hills, and he just offered, he basically on the spot said, you should think about coming to work for Blackbird. Like, he was going to introduce me to startups in the portfolio to see if they would hire me for some job. I had no idea what job at the time. I didn't know what I could do, what I was good at. I knew that I had success, some success in the things that I'd done, but you know, like nothing really that significant. And he did introduce me to some startups and I met them, but he also said, you should meet Rick and Sam, who are the two partners at Blackbird now, two of the six partners. And so I met Sam and I met Rick, and I don't think that they liked me that much. I was wearing a safari hat, I think, at the time, and I was just like not at all realizing, you know, what I was doing. Anyway, and they just said, we think there's a chance, we really need you to come and run this conference for us called Sunrise, but we think there's a role as head of community. Do you think you could have it run the conference for us and then try and shape a role out of it? And it was really risky at the time, in my view. I was leaving two businesses which were doing quite well. I was running a craft beer festival, which we'd grown from like six events a week to there was like 140 events in a week in October. Wow. So we'd grown that quite significantly. Band just won the Hottest 100, just put on a Horton Pavilion. But it still just didn't feel right. And it felt to me like Blackbird, there was opportunity at Blackbird, even though there was only, you know, three people there and we're sitting around these tiny desks. It's not like it is now where people want to come and work at Blackbird. You know, it's like a big office. There's lots of people, you know, we sort of have our shit together. Not really, but we somewhat look like we do. At the time it was tiny. And, you know, like, you know, we were using our own credit cards for expenses and then getting reimbursed. We're still doing that now, but it felt really just scrappy and messy. But it felt like there was possibility and opportunity in Blackbird. And so I made the decision to leave what I was doing and start fresh in VC.
And this, if I understand correctly, was 2016, is that right?
Yeah, 2016, yeah. February,
which was a few years into the Blackbird story from 2012-13, so three or so years in. And there's probably a couple of themes there that we can go into. I think particularly the one you mentioned at the start about Lauren Kaplan, how she had pitched a community role a couple of years before, and then to use your words, you said maybe it was ahead of its time. And then you went in on this, I understand, as a short-term project for the Sunrise Conference. And actually, in my research, I've been informed that you'd set yourself a target to sell X number of tickets, so which hopefully is correct. But maybe the first one there, and I know the guys at Blackbird talk about this a lot, is unlearning a lot of the things perhaps to go into a new field. Did you feel that? And obviously now you've been there for some time and you've had your own success and you've built your own identity within Blackbird. Did you, in the first 6 months or so, or maybe even the first 12 months, did you have to unlearn anything and relearn? Or was it because Blackbird was so early, you could just go in and try things and there was nothing to lose?
I'd say it's the latter. Like, you could just try a bunch of stuff. There wasn't a lot to lose at the time. But I feel like it wasn't unlearning. There was just, I think, a lack of maturity in the way I worked then. Like, I'd never worked in an organization before, really. Like, I spent a little bit of time in local government, but not long, not much. And, you know, the industry that I come from is like, it's aggressive and it's like dog eat dog. Like, there's no such thing as mentoring, or, you know, the mentality is that you have to fight as an artist manager, fight for your artists. Like, it's combat. Even with your partners, like you have, even like now people, the story of record labels and artists is well known. Labels take advantage of artists and artists, you know, are worse off for it. And so as a man, but they're your partners. They give you money. They help you. They distribute and sell your record for you. Like they are a partner. Like it should be a friendly and good relationship. But as a manager, you come up in a world where you got to fight and you got to be scrappy. And so I think I had to, that was the biggest thing to unlearn, was that in startups and in tech, you don't have to fire people. Everyone wants to help each other. And in fact, the best people recognize that by helping other people, you create the greatest opportunities for yourself. You build social capital, you increase your surface area of opportunity for things that you can do, either investing in or working on or helping or supporting. Like the whole system is set up to help and support people achieve what they want to do. And so I'd say that was the biggest cultural shift that I had to go through. And even still up to a couple of years ago, I was like in that mentality. I'd switched from fighting for artists to fighting for creativity and culture and meaning and value in what is essentially a financial services business. Well, we aspire to be more than that, but we give our money is the core of it. And so I saw myself as like someone who had to fight and defend those things, like creativity and value and meaning and richness. So I think that's like the biggest shift. And then everything that happened after that was, I guess, like an unfolding of myself and a realizing and recognizing and learning what I was, what I'm good at, what I enjoy, you know, good things and bad things about myself, and figuring out how to just look in the mirror.
That unfolding is one I want to go into, because I know you're very humble to admit this, but you've had a big impact in Blackbird, and that was one of the reasons to have you on, because the general startup community might not be as aware of the stamp that you've had at Blackbird, particularly because when you came in, you talked about community, culture. In my conversation with people, those are the words that come up when people think of you, as legacy, values, culture, community building. And these are big things for any company, whether it's big or small, but particularly for Blackbird, the size it is now. And that's probably the other part I want to learn from you, is you talked before going in, you had a safari hat, you were this kind of trailblazer and you were figuring it out. How did you figure it out? Like, did you go in and sit down with Nikki and Rick or Sam and build a plan, post the Sunrise conference? Like, how did it kind of unfold? Like, without, obviously it's a long story and you've been there for years, but how did that happen? Like, what was that transition point post doing the Sunrise conference and then going, here's a plan, this is what we want Blackbird to stand for, and then let's go out and create it?
So I would say that it was completely open for me to work out. Like, I don't think Nikki or Rick or Sam, and then later on Nick, I think Nick joined a few months after I did. These are all partners now at Blackbird. At the time, Nick was running Startmate. But I don't think anyone knew what it was meant to be. Like, no one, I had a vague sense that an activity that a community builder might do is run events or send out newsletters. Like, they had a vague sense of that's what it was. And Nikki particularly had a bunch of experience running Startmate and feeling and witnessing what community, the result of building community, but not really understanding the mechanics or the philosophy. Well, understanding the philosophy, but not really the mechanics of why you would do it and how you would do it. So I had to go and learn how to do it myself and build the strategy. And I found a community of community builders in a group called CMX, which was like this, it's still around. It's like this basically a community of community builders. And at the time, the community industry in tech was quite nascent. Anyway, so I used that course to give me some foundations and some language. But what I found is like the nuts and the bolts of community building, I'd actually been doing my whole life already. I just didn't have a name for it. And I didn't have the, you know, the frameworks or the language to kind of describe it or really to understand the ultimate impact. I had been doing it. Like, I even studied this stuff at university. Like, so I had a background in it. And the act of building audiences is for bands is like an, is, you know, there's a lot of community building that goes in that. The act of like starting a craft beer festival when there's no craft beer in Sydney and, you know, building something up from nothing to a point where there is now craft beer all over the place. Like, that is an act of community building. And so I found that I was like drawing on the experience that I had, and then my training, academic training, in like did a bit of anthropology stuff and a little bit of stuff in ritual and ceremony, things like that, cultural celebration. So I really, what I realized when I started the work, when I began it, I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm a fraud. How did I get this job? I'm going to lose it in a few months. To recognizing, oh, actually, I've been doing this my whole life. Like, I know what I'm doing now. And I think that's a mistake a lot of people make when they're hiring community managers, community builders, is that they think it's an easy job because, you know, sending out a newsletter, you can learn how to do that. Running an event is a skill, and you have to learn how to do it well, but you can learn how to do it. It's not rocket science once you know what you're doing. And so they make the mistake of thinking the activities of a community manager or a community builder are the same as all that other stuff I just talked about. Whereas really the toolkit of a community builder, like the tactical toolkit that you use, writing, you know, making events, communicating, relationships, that toolkit is quite, you can find that in a lot of people, but that underpinning that I mentioned is like the stuff that's actually quite difficult to obtain and to build up in yourself.
And another part that maybe is something that could be part of this, and tell me if I'm wrong, is you're not on the external founder-facing team. You're on the Building Blackbird team, so you're not part of the, obviously not part of the investment team. And one could say that limits you in terms of being aware of the audience, because back to kind of music, if you're not speaking to the audience, if you're at the back, how do you build something for the audience? How have you, over your time, balanced that out? Like, is Nikki and Nick and the investment team or other events that you attend, that's how you get your pulse on whether what you're building at Blackbird is actually resonating? Because how have you balanced that?
So I don't do community anymore at Blackbird. I was on the front-facing team. It was called community, and it was just me. And now it's called Founder Success, and there's a whole team running it. But that was very much customer-facing in the way that you put it. I was like, you know, I lived in Sydney at the time. I don't live there now, but, you know, I was out every week. I was traveling all over the place, spending time with our founders, you know, helping them to meet each other. So I was very much customer-facing then. And so it was easy for me to get a pulse then of what to build and what to make. Now my role is on the Building Blackbird team, which is about, the work I do now is internal facing, essentially. Mm. It's about building Blackbird and creating something exceptional and special in the business that we make. I still do external, like I work across all teams. So we still do external stuff now. Like I'm working on our two Sunrise conferences at the moment, building the brand. We're doing a rebrand at the moment. So I'm doing that, building a new website. Like all of this stuff is customer facing. But I think my years of working, you know, in community have given me a good base for that. But it is still like, you got to keep your finger on the pulse. You got to know what's going on. I don't read a lot of tech stuff anymore. I mostly focus on culture and arts and youth kind of stuff, just to try and figure out, you know, what's happening and what I should be paying attention to.
One of the things we talk a lot on the show about is painful learnings, whether that's in work or life. And it's intentionally called painful learnings because it might have been painful in the moment, but a learning in hindsight. Is there one for you that stands out? And this doesn't have to be Blackbird. It could be in your life, or it could be experience in general. What's been one that you learned the most from?
I think probably the most recent painful learning was about a year ago, when I think Blackbird's changed a lot over the years, particularly in the last 2 years. It's very, very different to what it was. And with that has come a bunch of, I guess, like a change in the way that I work. I've had to like adjust, you know, my disposition is the best way to put it. So like I mentioned before, I have always been in positions where I feel like I need to fight for the things that I think are important, because I don't think that everybody else sees that they're as important as I do. That started, I guess, like in the arts, you know, when I worked for bands, like I mentioned earlier, and it progressed into Blackbird, where you're working with people who have very different backgrounds to me, And my view has been like the things that are valuable to me and special about Blackbird, the things that make it a really, I think, like significant place to work. I think a lot of those things come from the culture and the meaning and the creativity and the values. And a lot of the stuff that I've worked hard to develop and create at Blackbird over the years. And so as we grew from like a really small team where you're like fighting and advocating for these things, then we grew to a big team. And all of a sudden in a bigger team of people, things like diplomacy, politics, advocacy, consensus building, all of those things become important. And there was quite a shock for me last year when I realized I hadn't been doing that work. I was still in the fight for what you believe in mode. And so I got some feedback from some colleagues that was, it was all about interpersonal reaction, like our interpersonal relationships. Now that I reflect back on it, it wasn't really about the work. It was more about, how I was, how I was approaching, conflict and the things that I felt were important and should be spent, given time and attention. And so I kind of had to learn, I'm still on the journey to learning about politics and diplomacy and building consensus. And now that we are a much larger organization with lots more people, there's a lot more complexity. You have to pay attention to people's, to what they want from their career, to how they see their role developing, to their insecurities, to their confidence, you have to understand all these things in order to be effective. And I did used to think that you could be effective by just fighting and pushing forward with something. And I've since learned that that's not the case.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you shared that. So thank you for being candid. I think that reminds me of a point that is probably the underappreciated points of your role is back to Blackbird building and a VC firm building. And you're seeing this with a lot of firms is the investment team gets the majority of the resources and they've got bigger teams and you could almost say it's a community of its own where they can talk and they go for lunches. And one could say, and I know you spoke about this in another podcast as well, where you're probably the only creative director in the industry in Australia. Like I'm not aware of any other VC firm having a title called creative director in the role you play. So how do you keep your kind of back to the feedback loops or learning journey internally? Like is that you talk with Nikki on a regular basis, or you've got someone outside, or you've got people that you connect with in the music industry. Because back to your point about learning, I think that's been my biggest learning is you don't need mentors per se, but people you can bounce ideas off and have that kind of jovial conversation that when you don't have a team can feel like it's missing.
Mm.
Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, totally. And I think it's fair to describe, and I'm not alone at this in Blackbird. Like Blackbird's an investment business. It is very investment centric. If you're on the investment team, you're at the core of the business. There's a lot of people in the investment team and a lot of people who work directly with the investment team. And, there are some of us at Blackbird who are kind of like individual contributors, like we're on little islands, it feels like sometimes. And so, hell yeah, like it's challenging, it's challenging working with that sometimes and getting the feedback and the bounce off people that you need. My role, though, is a lot about I work across different teams. And so I work with a bunch of different people in different departments. And so I found that that's like helpful to me to have this broad spectrum of experience with different people in different roles and departments at Blackbird. So that's helpful. But then, honestly, we haven't nailed it yet. Like I've never had a mentor in my life, I don't think. I'm sorry if someone's listening and they think they've been a mentor, but I've not really, we've never shook hands on it if that's the case. and so how do you get these things? And I think one of the things that we're trying to figure out and try and be better at Blackbird is how we do deliver feedback and how we are constructive with each other. We haven't nailed it like at all. Like we're on a journey to get there. And a big part of that is I think, as you grow and you get bigger, all of these things become harder to do and you have to build new systems and processes and ways of being with each other that facilitate and allow for that. So I think like that big bit of feedback I got last year was quite instructive. And I think, I will seek out more stuff like that, but Yeah, I would say it's not something I've nailed. And I hope that my I don't want to have those lightning bolt moments again in the future where you realize something about yourself that you didn't know. I would rather like realize things in the moment. And that's just about, I think, developing an EQ and developing the ability to reflect honestly on yourself and to not take yourself too seriously. And I think that's just something you get as you get a bit older.
At the same time, I feel like you're underplaying yourself because you actually are a custodian of the Blackbird culture. You talked earlier about doing the office fit outs, you're doing the website, you're doing the Sunrise conference. And as much as you said you're internal facing, you're actually very external facing. If anything, you're actually more broader than the transactional process of, oh, we meet a founder, we've got to invest, and we're going to have an IC meeting about it. So tell me about that. And I've had this similar conversation with Nikki, who's been on the podcast, and Nick Crocker as well. And they've spoken about it from different angles, but I think you bring a really unique sense of creativity and approach to business building and brand building. How do you look at that now, back to the conversation earlier about when you joined in 2016 and you had the safari hat and you didn't really know what you're doing, and now you've been there for a while and you do know some things that you're doing and you've got some runs on the board? What is the next stage of that kind of culture building and the values the firm stands for, and how do you reach that consensus with the broader team?
Well, thank you for saying that. It's very kind of you. I am, you know, without any kind of sense of false modesty, I do feel quite proud of the impact I've had. I think that without me at Blackbird, it would look entirely different. It would be a very, very different place. And I think that, you know, I'm proud of that impact and that legacy. And I think, like, going forward, what I'm thinking about at the moment as we build Blackbird is I've come to the realization over the last few years that everything we do, the impact that we're striving for, ultimately ladders up to culture and amounts to cultural change. And so I think, like, the way I think about my job is, how can I help Blackbird and people at Blackbird to realize how much we can actually impact Australian and New Zealand culture by doing the work that we do. And so what I mean by that is, like, you know, on the surface, it looks like, you know, we invest in tech companies, and, you know, I think tech companies, you know, they build software products, they solve deep problems that are really challenging. And that's true. That's a big part of what we do. But we also, like, by investing and funding these people that are really ambitious, that are trying to invent new things and come up with new solutions to problems and reshape the world that we live in, by investing in those people and by holding a mirror up for them to see themselves, but for the rest of Australia to see what we're capable of and New Zealand, I think that that ultimately could affect cultural change. And I think the way that I think about that is, like, we have a lot of work to do if we're to remain prosperous and, you know, if we're to even survive longer than the next century. And I think a big part of that work is around changing the way that we see ourselves in relation to the planet and to Earth, changing the way that we, you know, Australian and New Zealand's idea of ourselves and what we can achieve on a global kind of stage. The impact that all of these ideas have on how we see ourselves, how we speak about ourselves, the art we make, the, you know, so all of this stuff, I'm being a bit waffly, I think, but I see my role now as, like, trying to help Blackbird to realize that we can, that we are impacting culture, and that, and everyone in our industry is in startups and tech, we will impact Australian culture and New Zealand culture over the next, you know, decades. So take that seriously, and then let's, you know, actually, like, begin the work of recognizing that and then figuring out how we can do it better and more intentionally.
You've spoken a bit about taking inspiration from music and arts, and in other shows you've spoken about taking inspiration from religion and churches and architecture. Maybe another aspect of that in terms of inspiration is, if we just talk about venture capital and kind of business building in the tech space, is overseas firms. Like, I think of, particularly in the US, to your point about kind of generational firms, you've got the likes of Sequoia and A16Z are the two that come to mind, but they've both got very different brands. Like, Sequoia has got a very traditional financial services kind of mode to it, whereas A16Z was the new kid on the block, and they've used media in a very unique way, and community, and kind of this massive microphone and don't really give a shit mentality, and gone for some really big swings. Do you look at that in like, I know you said before that you kind of don't read tech much and you're more culture and arts, and that fits in with who you are, but is that something that maybe not now, but a couple of years ago you looked at and you're like, what are people like? I know Nikki reads a lot about China, for example. Is that something you do where you look at overseas markets and you're like, what's the 1% we can take inspiration from?
So no, honestly, like I don't look at other firms because I just don't think many people in VC in our industry do it very well. I think that historically brand, and when I say brand, I mean brand in the, as an expression of who you are as a group of people, you know, like, I mean, brand is like the description of who you are as like a group, what your values are, what you believe in, what you want the world to be, how you see your place in that puzzle. Like, I think when people think of brand, they think of like your logo and your graphics. And I think your graphics and the images you put out are a representation of those things you believe in and those things that you are. But I think about brand like much more broadly. And I don't think venture has really ever taken brand that seriously, which is kind of wild to me. Like, you know, like I think if any of our founders told us they weren't taking brand seriously, or that that was just something they weren't going to work on or think about, we would like laugh them out the door. Like there's no way they would get money from us. And I think if you look at some of the biggest brands in VC, Sequoia is obviously the number one. They up until recently have not taken platform, so venture platform or brand, that seriously. Like they've started to take it a bit more seriously recently, and their brand has been built up on their record, right? And and how fantastic, you know, they are as investors. And no one can deny that. They are the best investors in our industry. Maybe Tencent is up there as well in that echelon. But that's partly because they've been around for so long. Like they've got the record they've got because they've been investing for 40 or 50 years. Like that's part of it. And I think A16Z is like, you know, they have their own approach and their own style, but I don't look to venture brands for inspiration. I look to culture and arts and like who I think some of the most powerful and impactful brands in the world are, and I try and take inspiration from them. So I'm big, I've never been there, but I don't.
No, I think it's a great thing, and that's probably your unique value add, is because you bring that outside industry mentality. You're not trying to go, they're doing things, one thing so we can one up them or something along the line. So I love that. I want to bring the conversation kind of a bit broader, because we've spent some time talking about Blackbird, and I've thrown a lot of questions at you. Is back to kind of Nikki, one of the things he's curious about is, what does crypto have right and wrong about culture and community? Like, I know you spoke earlier about crypto, how yourself and Lauren follow accounts on Twitter, and I know that's something you're kind of curious about and you're growing your understanding about, but what do you think crypto has right about community and culture building?
So I think crypto is a huge universe, right? And I think people make the mistake of trying to like brush, you know, just one big brushstroke and that's all of crypto and Web3. I think it's a huge space. And I think there are people in it who are doing good and who have got it right and who understand what it really is. And then there are people who don't. And in my view, the most interesting things that are happening and the people who are doing the best work and who get it the most are people who understand culture. And I mean culture in this like larger kind of, I don't mean like culture as in like go listen to music and art and watch movies. I mean it as in culture as language. It's how we explain the world that we live in. It's how we understand the world that we live in. It's how we describe what we think the world should be. And the artifacts of culture are written. They're, you know, like I said, it's language. They're symbols. They're, you know, they're our rituals and our celebrations. Like culture is, it's the apex of everything. Everything ladders up to culture. And I think the people who get crypto the best see that crypto is like at its best a new kind of like it impacts culture. And so what we've gotten right, I think about it is, and I hope this is like, it's very nascent and we're still not, it's not promised that we will achieve this, but I think the biggest change to me, this idea of ownership. And like I come from a space when I worked in the arts and in music, there is no concept of ownership. The people who make things don't own anything. And this is true for all like all creative things. If you write books, you don't own anything. Like publishers buy your work from you and exploit it. If you're in music, it's the same. Film, it's the same. The people that create the value, that make the thing that has such a strong and deep impact on the world, or has the potential to anyway, in these industries, they do not benefit. And I think the result of that is less creativity, less high quality art, less people spending their life becoming really, really great at their chosen expression or whatever it is. And I think the promise to me of Web3 and of crypto is that we might finally change the culture of ownership in the arts and in people who make things, essentially make things that make our lives more meaningful and worth actually like living. And so I think if we can achieve that, I think the world will be a much better place and more people will spend more time making things, which will be better for everybody. And that's what I hope.
And a follow-up to that, which was another Nikki question was, and this one's really interesting, so I'm curious as to how you answer it, is how does Australia encourage more Vitalics into the world? So for people who might not be aware, he's the founder of Ethereum, I believe, if I'm correct. So I'm assuming Nikki's had this conversation with you. That's why he's asked me to ask you. But yeah, I don't even know what that question exactly means, but how does Australia encourage more of a Vitalic personality into the world?
So for people that don't know, Vitalik is the founder.
Sorry, wrong pronunciation.
Oh, no, that's okay. It's fine. He's the founder of Ethereum. And you just need to go look this guy up. He's completely individual. He's uniquely himself. And I think when I look at him and when I look at, say, Greta Thunberg and people like that, I see a person who has been allowed and encouraged and has had the tools to fully discover who they are and to develop and follow curiosities and passions such that their experiences in life, the things they're interested in, how they grew up, the language they speak, all amount to a personality and a person that is entirely unique that can never be copied. We're all like this, right? But I think many of us, unfortunately, fall short of that true expression of who we are. And so how do we create more Vitalics? We create a world where we encourage people from a young age and teach them to follow their passions and their curiosities. And I think that will lead, and if you can help people to do that, I think that will lead us to a place where more people are creating more things which are entirely unique and completely, a result of their unique life experiences. And I think that's how we get more people like him. Like, go and look at him. Just go look at him online. He is like 100% himself. The guy's weird as nuts. He's obviously a genius, but he like does these weird, he has a weird style of travel, which he's written about. He like wears clothes that he likes that kind of doesn't, like when you think about the model of a person who has invented a world-changing technology and is like in charge of this giant movement, you don't picture a dude who walks around like this, right? Who walks around wearing the clothes he wears, saying the things he says, like posing for photos, walking around the street like he's nobody. Like, he's entirely himself and unique. And I think if we can inspire more people to be unique and to be themselves and to follow their curiosities and their passions, we'll end up with more people like that.
We're running short in time, but one of the questions that a number of people mentioned in my homework was that your thinking process and your memory, and they said you think in pictures rather than, you don't think in pictures, but rather themes. And I think you recently tweeted about this. So there's a term that you found that I don't have on hand with me at the moment, but it's a big question. And I know we can spend hours talking about this, but is there anything about that that's changed the way you work?
Yeah, totally. So it's called, I've only recently discovered this about myself. I don't have a medical diagnosis, but I've done all these tests that indicate it's true. It's called aphantasia. And it's the lack, you can't form images in your mind's eye. So if I ask you to close your eyes and picture a red apple, and then ask you to describe the crispness of that picture, like, is it red? How clear is the picture? Is it moving? Is anything else happening? A lot of people can describe in various detail, like what's an image that, like a photo or a film that comes up in their mind, and I can't do that. When I picture a red apple, I don't see anything. And what that's meant and what I've learned from like being involved in some communities of people who have the same thing, and it is a recognized neurological thing. There are people just researching it and discovering it now. What it's meant is that for me and other people with it, you become a much more conceptual and abstract thinker because you can't visualize things. So the way you understand things and recall memories and everything is more conceptual than it is visual. And so I think that that's impacted the way I am, the way I think, and the way I approach my work. I'm super conceptual about it. Like when I start a new project or when I want to build something new, I start at the very top, like conceptual thinking, and work my way down to the details. There's a lot of people, that's like top-down thinking. A lot of people that I work with are bottoms-up thinkers. Like if you want to bring some founders together, the first thing they'll think of is what venue are we going to use and what food will be served. Whereas I'll think at the top and it will be like, you know, what are we trying to achieve here? How does this thing feel? What's the journey? You know, are there any rituals or things that we want to get out of this? And then you work your way down to the food and stuff like that. But I'd say that's like been the biggest, I think that's made me like fairly, like that's, I think what makes me good at my job is that ability to think like that.
I was going to say exactly that that's probably your unique sort of secret sauce is that conceptual big picture thinking 10 years out or grand vision. So super awesome. We've got a few minutes left, so I'd love to finish with a rapid fire final sprint. Is there one investment you've made that you consider the best in your life, non-financial?
Yeah, 100%. It was going to Chulster University and studying theatre media. So a lot of things happened out of that. Firstly, I met my wife there. We've been together for 17, 18 years, and she's like just changed everything for me. I think I would have floated off and burnt up in the atmosphere much, much sooner if it wasn't for her. And so I met her in the second year, but then also this degree is where I really learned to make things and to be resourceful and to think from first principles. And it's where I built an appreciation and love of culture and people and anthropology, and it's where I learn about creativity, honestly.
Is there one thing you'd like to learn in the next 6 months?
Yeah, I'm trying to learn keyboard piano. I'm trying to learn to play piano.
Oh, I can see it behind you.
Yeah, I'm not very we're so busy at the moment though, I haven't really been able to focus, but I'm using an app to teach me.
Nice. I think there was actually a company in the ProStars program last year that they do a keyboard on the computer, if I'm correct. So yeah,
called SyncBeat, where you can jam online with people through MIDI controller and a website.
Super cool. This is one that actually your wife suggested I ask you, is if you had to imagine the day your eldest child moved out of home, what's the one lesson or attitude you'd ask them to have or ask them to keep?
Just, I've mentioned it a lot of times, just be yourself, follow your passions and curiosities. That's not a lot of advice young people get these days. They're told to plan and be sure and know what's coming and be sensible about your career and your life and think about this decision and the impact it will have in 10 years from now. And I think my life, I've led a really rich life and I wouldn't change anything about it. And that's largely in part because I've followed my curiosities and my interests and my passions.
And last one, is there one thing you do every week to get the best out of yourself mentally and physically?
I think like at the moment I go for a walk every morning with my dog and I listen to books or I like just think, and I think that's probably the healthiest habit I have at the moment. I do that most days. I didn't do it this morning because I was preparing to speak to you. But I think that's probably the largest thing. Oh, and also I've been playing Warzone, Call of Duty Warzone with my friends at night. And I have a lot of friends from music who I don't get to see very often. And especially during the pandemic, it's just a chance for us to kind of decompress and, you know, shoot the shit and just, hang out together. And so that sounds silly because it's a video game and I'm like 40 years old, but it's like been a really great social and community building thing for me to get into. So walking the dog and hanging out with friends at night.
Well, I mean, actually, I actually wrote an article a while back about the power of play, and I referenced the Shopify founder, Toby Lutke, I think, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And he talks about video games being a huge part of how he thinks and operates today. So I'd say to your point about video games coming across as a bit childish, absolutely not. I mean, there's some super people making a huge dent in the world that talk about video games being a huge part of their DNA.
Well, I will tell you, I'll leave the you and your audience with this to go and look up. There's this out of the MIT Media Lab, they've written a book called Lifelong Kindergarten, which has been really instructive and effective for me in my work with the Blackbird Foundation. And they have this loop called the four P's, and it's about, this is how you develop creative skills and how you do creative learning in young people. And the four P's are people, projects, passion, and play. And those things together form this like flywheel, but once you get going in people, it's impossible to stop.
I love that. It sounds like absolute magic for me. I've just made a note. I will check it out straight after this. But Joel, man, thanks so much for joining me on this. I loved having you on and wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure and an honor that you would consider having me on the show.
There you have it. I hope you took away some actionable insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your life and be 1% better. And to stay up to date on all upcoming episodes, just subscribe or follow us on your podcast app and on LinkedIn or Instagram.